I like to be ambitious. Can we do that? We'll be ambitious. Go team. See a lot of fists. People are excited. I like to be ambitious. I like to cover a lot. What we're going to do is we're going to look at the miracle of Hanukkah. We're going to learn three things. Three things? My kids are 3 years old and they're like learning this. They're figuring out how to do three on their fingers. We're going to do three things. We're going to learn three things about the modern state of Israel. But really, we're going to learn three things about ourselves. Okay, because it's like, it's nice to talk about Israel, but we don't want to talk about it if it's not something for us. We're going to learn three things about ourselves. So let's just jump right into it, okay? On the cover, what we have over here is a picture that adorns a medieval era, very, very old manuscript of the Rambam's Mishneh Torah, the book of Zmanim in particular, the book of holidays, which is, of course, what we are about to engage in. The first thing, if we just turn over to page one, the first thing I want to talk about that we learn from Hanukkah is seizing the initiative. So just look with me over at source number one, please. This comes from a book called Days of Deliverance from Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. I know he's not the hometown Rabbi Soloveitchik, but he's okay too, I promise. Okay, and he says, what is Hanukkah? How did the Almighty use the Hasmoneans in order to save the covenantal community? Did he act as he acted in Egypt, where he just informed Moses what he had in store for them? Or did he require of the Hasmoneans total involvement, sacrificial action, heroic decisions, and courageous plans, as he demanded from Joseph? The Hasmoneans seized the initiative. God willed them to defend the sanctuary, to guard the honor of Jewish women, the pride of the people, and the grandeur of the Torah. They fought like lions, selflessly and with unqualified devotion. Of course, God defeated the enemy after man did his part. The Hasmoneans were confronted by the same destiny as Joseph, the destiny of suffering. It is a great and heroic destiny, but a very difficult one. The line's really not very difficult to draw from Hanukkah to Zionism, modern Zionism, in this regard. Right? We all know that what is the history of modern Zionism, if not taking initiative, seizing the initiative. So look over here with me at source number two. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein Zatzal was interviewed by Rabbi Chaim Sabato in an unbelievable, wonderful book you have to read, you have to, called Mevakshei Panecha. Okay, and Rav Sabato just asked Rav Lichtenstein like every important question that he had in the world, and Rav Lichtenstein gave the best answers ever, and you have to read it. Okay, and this is what he writes about this particular point. He says, Emdat Tzionit. Okay, the stand of Zionism, kolel hadatim shebetocha, including the religious people among them, v'harabanim shebetocha, and the rabbis among the Zionists, ha'amina shelozu belvat she'adam yachol, they believe that not only is it so that people are able, lozu belvat she'adam rashai, not only is it so that people are permitted, ela gam shu mechuyav litol liyadot ha'sharbit, people must take the baton of history. Must take. He must build the best possible world that he can. The best possible spiritual world and the best possible social world. This is the case. This is not something simply to read about in Hanukkah. And you know, it's a nice story, right? It's a nice story. Look at that. The Syrian Greeks come in and they're ruining everything. We don't have any prophets. And Matityahu and his sons decide, well, this can't be. This can't be. So they decide to do something about it. It wasn't as though they heard a voice from heaven. It wasn't as though they had some clear indication this is going to work. They didn't know. And let's keep in mind, there are no guarantees here. If you think about the Bar Kokhba revolt, very similar situation, right? We have a foreign invader from very far, maybe overextending themselves. Maybe we have an opportunity at independence. And they do their best, right? And then what does that last? 3 years? Not every rebellion is going to go your way. They seize the initiative. Not only is it so that we are permitted to do so, Rav Lichtenstein says, we must do so. That is the lesson for us. Now, we're in a different stage, right? This is not the 1800s. This is not even the early 1900s in Europe. We're at a different stage of tasks and challenges, to be sure. But we have to assess what our challenges are. We have to take the initiative. So if you look over at source number three on page two, so I was just, you know, Googling around, looking at these different ideas of sacrifice that you can find online. I found an article from 1941. Okay, this is the headline. Ben-Gurion asks Palestine youth for sacrifices. 6,400 settlers await land. David Ben-Gurion, chairman of the Jewish Agency Executive, yesterday called on Palestine Jewish youth to make the utmost efforts and sacrifices to defend Palestine. He declared before the 7th Annual Congress of the Jewish Youth Organizations, what can Jewish youth give to Zionism? Life. What can Zionism give to Jewish youth? An ideal. There's something very, very deep in that. You know, there's this psychologist I like to listen to from Canada named Jordan B. Peterson. And he says, there are two paths in life. Have you heard me say this? No? There are two paths in life. The first path is where you sit back and you think you're going to have it easy. But then you feel really bad about yourself and you just suffer. That's the first path. And the second path is where you gear yourself up and you work very hard and you take up the courage. You think about who you admire. I want to be like that person. And you know what you do? You suffer. But you suffer for a reason. Okay? This is something which I think, I'll tell you, in my generation, we feel very acutely today. It feels like we're rudderless. And this is still true when it comes to Zionism. When it comes to all of us, not just the youth, when it comes to all of us, we can give life to Israel, but Israel gives us a reason. It gives us a reason. The state of Israel gives us an ideal. And I want to bring home just something. This idea of taking the initiative is not something which only has to do with Zionism, the state of Israel. It's not. It has to do with everything in our lives. I was just reading a book by this guy, Neil Ferguson, in Source Number 4. He wrote a book called Civilization, the West and the Rest. And this book, in short, is summarized in this little article which he wrote in the Telegraph, and it's called Why the West is Now in Decline. For 500 years, Western civilization was full of self-belief, but now, historian Neil Ferguson argues in his new Channel 4 series, he turned his book into a TV series, not a bad trick, its dominance is coming to an end. In my new book and series, I argue that what distinguished the West from the rest, the mainsprings of global power, were six identifiably novel complexes of institutions and associated ideas and behaviors. For the sake of simplicity, I summarize them under six headings. 1. Competition. 2. Science. 3. Property rights. 4. Medicine. 5. The consumer society. 6. The work ethic. To use the language of today's computerized, synchronized world, these were the six killer applications, the killer apps, that allowed a minority of mankind originating on the western edge of Eurasia to dominate the world for the better part of 500 years. This is of more than purely historical interest, for it is only by identifying the causes of Western ascendancy that we can hope to estimate with any degree of accuracy the imminence of our fall. My conclusion is that we are already living through the twilight of Western predominance. But that is not just because most of the rest have now downloaded all or nearly all of our killer apps. It is also because we ourselves have lost faith in our own civilization. As I said, this is a fascinating book, Civilization. So each chapter is about one of these six things that made the West ascendant between 1500 and the year 2000. And you know how he ends each chapter with like a warning. You know, it used to be that only the West had competition. It's an unbelievable thing. Between the years 1000 and 1500, if you wanted to go to an advanced society, you'd go to China, you might go to the Islamic countries, you would not go to Europe. Europe was like a little garbage hole where they fought each other all day and they had like 14 people who were sick and poor and dying. It was terrible. And one of the things that kickstarts Europe in 1500s, they start to compete. They start to compete economically, whereas China decides, you know what, we're not going to go overseas in search of anything anymore. We're going to stay at home. And so what happens is that China starts to fall behind, the West starts to move ahead, and this works for 500 years. And in his chapter on science, he says, look how amazing science is! Because you can have a totally beleaguered, tiny state, the state of Israel, and they use science to defend themselves. But then, like all the other chapters, he ends with a warning. And the warning is, well, now they've got science too. And we're not that far ahead. This is in 2010. It's a little ominous. This is what he's writing in 2010. Listen, I'm not a politician. I'm also not a scientist. But we can all see that it is so that in Hanukkah it worked then, seizing the initiative is the only thing that we can do now. We have to seize the initiative. Whatever that means. Whatever that means. And we all know that there are many, many different things that we can do, whether it is actually moving to Israel and joining the society of the state of Israel, or if it's donating money or supporting people or helping however we can. But it is absolutely so that from writing an email to your congressman or whatever, we have to seize the initiative because it's not enough to sit back and it's not even enough to only pray. We have to seize the initiative and pray. If you look at the bottom, by the way, this is an unbelievable thing. So Ferguson's writing about the end of Western civilization, which he thinks is imminent. If you look on the bottom, so you have the first form of Western civilization, as most historians look at it. So that's the Arch of Titus, Okay, which if you've ever read Josephus, right, so he writes a book, The History of the Jewish War, and at the end of the Jewish War, so Jerusalem is totally destroyed, and what the Romans do is they go into the temple, and they loot it, and they take everything out, and Josephus writes about this procession that they did. What the Romans would do is they would build a victory arch, a giant arch. I don't know if you've ever seen, there's a ton of these around Manhattan and Brooklyn, okay? They would build a victory arch, and you would march through it with all of your fancy things, okay? And the Arch of Titus is actually sort of a report. It's telling everybody in Rome what it looked like in Jerusalem. They said, look, we took their Torah, we took their menorah, look at all this amazing stuff that we got. We're the greatest. We conquered them. Okay, now the arch they built outside of Jerusalem was long gone, but the Arch of Titus is still standing here. And if you look on the left side, you can actually see a colorized version. Dr. Stephen Fine from YU, I actually had him the semester before I came here. So he found some pigmentation still on the arch, and they reconstructed what it originally looked like. Okay, so you can actually see this is what the Romans were telling everybody the procession looked like. Okay, over here on the left. It's also, by the way, a common misconception. People assume that Jewish slaves are carrying everything. This is the booty that the Romans got. They would never let you touch anything. Okay, obviously these are Roman soldiers. Okay, but they fell too. Now, these aren't things that are inevitable. Right? Again, the Bar Kokhba revolt is the failure of revolt. But the Chashmonaim is when it works out. It's not inevitable, obviously, failure. Rather, it's that we must seize the initiative and continue. Now, one of the things I think that sometimes we feel sensitive. You know, the religious Zionist community in America is, it's a minority, right? I think sometimes we can feel sort of on the defense. Maybe this is just me. We can sort of feel like there are more Orthodox Jews out there who say what we're doing is wrong than what we're doing is right. And I can tell you that I have very wonderful cousins I'm very close with. I used to go to their house all the time for Shabbos when I was in Israel in Yeshiva and in Bar Ilan. And my cousin was extraordinarily right wing. And he would always like argue with me, and we'd argue back and forth. We had a great time, but and he would tell me, like, Zionism's so terrible. What are you doing? It's totally secular. They hate God, this, that. Why are you a Zionist? And so this is something that we have to think about. And the truth is, the answer to this question, we shouldn't feel embarrassed. We shouldn't feel on the defense. We should know this is where we stand. This is totally fine. This is the right thing to do. The answer, one of the places that it comes from, is actually Hanukkah. Okay, in Hanukkah we can learn the value of sovereignty. The value of the Jewish people having sovereignty, ruling themselves. The truth is, it's a no-brainer. Okay, there's a very famous argument between the Rambam and the Ramban. Okay, the Rambam writes a book of 613 commandments. Okay, anybody know which one he left out? Yeshuvah, that's right, Yeshuvah Eretz Yisrael. The Rambam doesn't list it. That's not our share tonight. Okay, but the Ramban jumps up and down and he's like, what's this guy doing? Where's he been? Of course there's a mitzvah to live in the land of Israel. And what he counts over there is not simply living in the land of Israel. He says you have to settle it. You have to be the sovereign. You have to be ruling it, okay? And the word used over there by our salvation when he talks about appointing a Sanhedrin is sovereignty. There is a commandment, the Ramban tells us, to have sovereignty. But even the Rambam, who doesn't list it as a separate commandment, says you have to do it. And one of the rayas, a proof that it's a good thing, comes from Hanukkah. Because if you look in the beginning of the Mishnah in Yoma, so the beginning of the Mishnah in Yoma talks about what do we do with the Kohen. Okay, and one of the things that the Mishnah says, and this is so weird, and I remember this being weird when I was a kid, is that you have to say to the Kohen, are you sure you know what you're supposed to do on Yom Kippur? Did you learn all the rules? Like, what are you telling me? He's the Kohen Gadol! You tell me the high priest doesn't know what to do? And the Rambam comments over there on the third Mishnah in Yom, he says, you know what? A lot of the high priests, they're totally ignorant. Because the Chashmonaim would sell the Kohuna. They would sell the position of being the Kohen Gadol to the highest bidder. So, you know, there's a lot of corruption. So you had people who didn't know anything. And so you'd have like the Kohen Gadol walking around the Beis HaMikdash, and he's like got guides next to him. They're like, no, no, don't do that. You'll die if you do that, right? That's not the right spice. Okay. So you're talking about a corrupt society, corrupting the Beit HaMikdash itself, which is so deeply ironic because, of course, the main legacy of the Chashmonaim is Hanukkah, rededicating the temple. But unfortunately, they became corrupt and they came to destroy the entire thing. They ruined it. But even so, what does the Rambam tell us? If you look in the beginning of Hilchot Chanukah, okay, the Rambam puts together Megillah and Chanukah, Purim and Chanukah in one book, and that makes sense because this book is highly organized. Okay, the Mishnah Torah, exactly 1,000 chapters containing 613 commandments, no more, no less, very, very well organized. And he puts together Purim and Chanukah because those are two rabbinic holidays. And he says, you know, look, in Bayit Sheni, Kishamachu Yavan, when Yavan, you had these Syrian Greeks who became kings in the land of Israel on page 3, Gazru Gzeirota Yisrael Ubitlu Datam. Okay. So they made all sorts of decrees. Vlohinicho Otam La'asok V'Torah Mitzvot. They wouldn't allow the Jews to do any Torah or Mitzvot. So my children tell me. Upashtu Yadam V'Monam U'V'Noteyam. Okay, they made different sexual sins, and they destroyed walls around the temple, and they made things impure. The Jews were very, very oppressed. And they really pressed the people until God saved them. Until the Hashmonaim came, and they saved them, and they killed them. And they saved the Jews from them. And they made a king from the Kohanim, so Rabbi Yehuda Amital of Yeshivat Haaretzion points out, he says, wait a second, why does the Rambam tell us, wow, the Hashmonaim ruled for 200 years? They're not such good guys! What are you so excited about, Rambam? The answer is that even when they're not such good guys, even people who sell the Kohen Gadol's position, were still excited when there's a sovereignty for 200 years. That's something to celebrate. It's very, very exciting. If you look on the next page, you know, Chazal are not ignorant. Sorry, if you look on page 5 for a second. Chazal are not ignorant of the various sins of the kings of the Hashmonaim. And yet, they make several holidays, days when we don't fast and we don't make any eulogies for different things that the Hashmonaim do. Because it's not so simple. It's not so simple that they're supposed to be these unbelievable tzaddikim all the time. That's what we want. That's what we should deserve if we really earn it. But when it's not so, that doesn't mean it erases all the good that a person does. And so when they fix the walls of the temple, that's a holiday. And when they make it so, when they get rid of this practice of making Jews go to non-Jewish courts to deal with their questions in law, that's a holiday. The reason there are so many holidays is because we appreciate these things. And again, the lesson is clear for us that we should celebrate everything that is good. We don't have to be blind to things that we don't like. We don't have to be blind to things that aren't our values. But we don't have to blind ourselves from the things that are good. That would just be absurd. It'd just be absurd. Why would anyone think that's a good idea? So forget that. Go back to page number 4 for a second. Okay. We actually look at this coin on the top. There are two coins in history which are the most common nowadays to find from the ancient era. So one of them is actually, if you look on page 3, it's a Judea Capta coin. Sorry, no, I'm making you jump around a little bit. So if you look at the Judea Capta coin, it's the far side on the right. What you can see is a Roman soldier standing strong over a very sad Jew sitting next to the tree. Okay, and this is the Judea Capta coin that the family of Vespasian says, look, we are the emperors of Rome and we're very important because we quashed the rebellion in Judea. Okay, Judea Capta. All right, Judea is captured. Yehuda is captured. If you look on the far left, this was a coin that Israel put out as a response. All right, and you can see a pioneer sort of digging, and it looks like a woman's holding up a baby. Okay, and that's the Herut. Okay, and they say, look, we turned it around. Okay, that's the most common coin in all of history because it was passed all around the Roman Empire and they find it all over the place. The next most common coin, I believe, is the coin that you see on page 4. And this was actually done, if you look at your little chart on the bottom of page 4, this was made, I believe, by John Hyrcanus I, level 3 over there, you see that? Oh, sorry, Alexander Janaeus, level 4 in the middle. Alexander Janaeus, so it used to be that the Hashmonaim would say that we are the Nasi. We say, we're the Kohen Gadol, and we're the Nasi. We're like the head of the Jews. They never called themselves Melech. Okay, but then you have Alexander Janaeus, okay, whose name is Yonatan, and he decided to call himself Melech, and he stamped it on a coin. And the people said, you're not our king. You have to be from Beit David to be a king. And they refused to use the coin. So they took all the coins and they just sat in the palace. And that's why there are so many of them, because nobody ever used them to destroy them. Okay? So look at source number 6 for a moment. This comes from the Gemara in Yoma. So the Gemara over there says, the Amar Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi says, not Lama Nikra Shemana Anshei Knesset HaGadola. Why is the Anshei Knesset HaGadola, the great anonymous court that made so many of the important rules that we have in Judaism, from the Shemona Esrei to just everything, why are they called great? Why is that? Shehechziru Atar Al Yoshna, because they made God great again. Atar Moshe Amar, you know, Moshe came and he said, Hakel HaGadol HaGibor Ba'anara. Okay, God who is great and strong and awesome. Atah Yirmiyah v'amar, and then Yirmiyah came and he said, Nochrim mekakrim behechalo, ayin noratav. He said, you have all these people came and destroyed his temple and they're dancing on God's home. Where is his awesomeness? Lo amar norah. So he took out that word when he davened. Atah Daniel, Daniel came. Amar nochrim mishtabedim bivanav. He says, you have people enslaving the Jewish people. Ayin noratav, where is his strength? Lo amar gibor. So he took out the word gibor. Atu inhu va'amru, then the Anshei Knesset HaGadola came. And they said, Adrab, on the contrary, zuhi givurat givurato, shekovesh et yitzro. He says, no, they said, you don't understand. What's God's strength? That he holds back his anger. Shenotin erech apayin rishayim. Because even when the Jewish people are bad, he doesn't punish them fully. You know what makes him awesome? How would it be possible for one little nation to keep on going between all the nations of the world? It's never been done. There's only one people that's ever done it. That's what makes God awesome. And they put it back in Davening. Hagibor v'hanora. Okay? So Rav Nachum Eliezer Rabinovich points out, he says, what are they appreciating over here? They're saying, look at this. We were enslaved. We're not enslaved anymore. That's something that makes us appreciate God. This, the Gemara says, is what makes the Anshei Knesset HaGadola great. They're great because they recognize the importance, among other things, but they recognize the importance of saying, wow, God has given us the ability to rule ourselves. Now, what are we supposed to do if not to copy the Anshei Knesset HaGadola? What are we supposed to do if not to copy them? The answer is obviously to do the same. If God has given us sovereignty, we need to appreciate it. We need to value it. When we daven, that should be something we feel in the very first bracha, Shmona Esrei. Let's turn to page 6. So I want to read to you from, if you ever learned Orot, Rav Kook's Orot. So he has a little introduction. And he didn't write the introduction actually for the book Orot. He wrote it for his Degel Yerushalayim. Banner of Jerusalem was a semi-political group that he wanted to get off the ground, that he wanted to change the face of what was then Palestinian society. Degel Yerushalayim. And this is what he wrote. It's the renaissance of a holy nation on the holy soil. This is translated by Bezalel Naor in his translation of Orot. He has a wonderful book that came out last year called When God Becomes History, which is just essays from Rav Kook translated to English. It's a must read. Add it to your Amazon list. He said, Rav Kook said, we are speaking of the soul of our national renaissance, the root of life of the aspiration to build the land, our holy land, by the living people. That is the renaissance of the holy. The treasure of life of the holy is stored in every heart of Israel. In the nation as a whole, this is the power that controls all its ways and essence. The nation's longing for its origin, its renaissance, its land, exists only in the quality of holiness that is peculiar to its character. The dimension of secular renaissance is but a corridor before the banquet hall, the first steps of the child begins to walk, which will eventually bring him to run as a strong man. The truth is we're sort of walking on a progression over here. Because the first thing that we learn from Hanukkah is that you need to seize the initiative. When you see something's wrong, you deal with it. Right? Get on with it. Start something. And when you have success and God grants you success, so appreciate it. And it may not be perfect, but you have to appreciate it. And that becomes in your spiritual world. That becomes part of your spiritual world. But the last step is again to seize the initiative. It's not to rest on our laurels. And there's no one else who could do it. It has to be us. It has to be us. What Rav Kook is saying is that, good, we got sovereignty. But that's the corridor to what's next. Okay? Look in page number 7. This is from a book of essays by Rav Nachum Rabinovich. And this section is called Matarat HaTorah, the goal of the Torah, which is Tikkun HaNefesh v'Tikkun HaChevra. the perfection of the soul and the perfection of society. It's always, I don't know, it's a very ambitious thing to say, well, I'm going to tell you what the goal of Torah is, right? But here it is from the Rambam. He's a good guy. We can trust him. So, Limadnu Mora HaDorot, he said, the teacher of all generations, meaning the Rambam, he wrote as follows in the Mor Nevuchim, okay? This is in the third book in the 57th chapter. He wrote it in Arabic. The Mor Nevuchim is a fascinating little story. The Rambam wrote it as a series of letters. It was not written as a whole book. It was written as a series of letters to a student of his who was some towns away. But for whatever reason, he thought, this is a pretty seminal thing, I'm going to copy it, and we'll start disseminating it around Egypt. And it became immediately very, very popular. And this is written in Judeo-Arabic, and it gets translated immediately. Okay, this is a very big deal. It's caused the Maimonidean controversy with burning the Rambam's books and things like this. Is everyone familiar with that? No? Oh my goodness. Another sheer. Okay. Come back next time. Forget that Blaker guy. Okay. So the Rambam writes like this, okay? He says, Kavanat kol ha-Torah. Okay, those are big words. The intent of the entire Torah. Those are big words, right? Yeah, big words. Kavanat kol ha-Torah shnei devarim. There are two main intents in the Torah. Vehim tikinut ha-nefesh u-tikinut ha-guf. Fixing the soul and perfecting the body. Tikinut ha-guf tiyeh b'tikinut matzavei chayehem eila emeila. When you talk about perfecting the body, what he really means is perfecting the ability of people to live amongst each other. Good governments. Da, you should know. One of these two goals is more important. B'li safek, without any doubt, the tikunot ha-nefesh is much more important to perfect your soul. Ha-matara ha-shniya, tikunot ha-guf, their second goal, which is allowing people to live properly with each other, however, kodemet b'teva uvizman. It comes naturally first in terms of time. You have to work on that first. You have to make sure that people can live with each other, because that's, you know, it's a very, very famous comment of Chazal. He said, why didn't Yaakov know what happened to Yosef? Why didn't God just tell him? And they said, well, you know what? He wasn't happy, and God can't contact you and speak to you in Ruach HaKodesh or prophecy when you're unhappy. And I remember as a kid thinking, like, I don't know, that seems dumb. Like, what's the difference? Well, I can't be a sad prophet. But the truth is, everybody knows that when it comes to personal growth, we can only grow on an individual level when we're in a state of equilibrium, right? When you're sort of thrown off kilter, you're just trying to get your balance. I just need a job. I just need a place to live. I just need food to eat. When you live like that, if you have a society where you're in destruction all the time and total chaos reigns, you cannot grow spiritually. You cannot have prophecy in that kind of society. So first, always, the Rambam tells us, comes the perfect society. Matara shniya zot hi amudgeshet yoter. It's obviously easier to understand having a good society. Okay, and there's a lot of details to this that they had to give us. And it's important to make sure that society functions properly in order to get to our second goal, which is perfection of the soul. A lone person can't do this at all. It must be in a society. We have to bind together in order to reach our spiritual goals. Because people are social animals in their nature. Torah Moshe Rabbeinu, the Torah of Moshe Rabbeinu ba rak lamed otano et shtei hashlomiyot gam yacha. The Torah comes to teach us both of these things. Kolomar tikinut matzavei b'nei adam eila emeila, to perfect our ability to live with each other al yedei bitul ha'oshek, by getting rid of all oppression, shebnei adam oshkim ze'etzeh, which people oppress each other with, va'yedei sigul midot tovot meulot, and by, of course, teaching us good character and how to treat each other. Kedesh efshar yeh le'anshe ha'aretz itkayem u'lehatmid v'seder achad. So that people can get along. Kedesh kol achad mehem yagil l'shlem muto ha'rishona. First, that everyone can reach tikun ha'gul, perfection of society and a perfection of your personal life. And then you'll be able to gain the right ideas. Then you'll be able to really live your life appropriately. First, we have to have sovereignty. And once we have sovereignty, the Rambam tells us, then you have to have the good society. You can't have chaos. And once we have chaos, once we don't have chaos, we have order, then is the time to grow. Then is the time to grow. And the truth is, most people can't articulate in a sentence why they have to grow. Why do you have to grow? What's the difference? Go explain to someone. Tell them, I have it for you. It's easy if you're sitting in this room. Oh, I got the Torah. God spoke to me. He said you have to grow. God said there's a whole world. You're a world. You're important. Your life matters. But if you don't have any of those things, or even if you have those things, but they feel distant from you. So, what are you supposed to say? One of the unique strengths, and therefore challenges, of being a religious Zionist Jew is that we can articulate the goal and we know we have to pursue it. We know it's on us because no one else can do it. There is no one else who can even say what the challenge is, either because they don't recognize Judaism and the task that you have as a Jew, or because they recognize the task that we have as a Jew, but they don't realize that history is in the making, that we're supposed to have a part in it. So that means that 5% of Orthodox Jews, or of Jews in America, can go and articulate a vision and say we have a responsibility as individuals and as a collective to do something. And not to say we'll sit on our laurels and isn't that great, but to say, what's next? To keep pushing. And that's a really tall order because, after all, we're all sort of normal people. We're all sort of regular people, and we go to work and we're busy with that. We've got families, we're busy with that. And we're just busy and we're tired, and isn't that hard? And it's the long haul. I want to read a Gemara with you in source number 9. This comes from the Talmud Bavli, also in Masechet Yoma. So the Gemara says over there, Kititanya, this is on the bottom. You know, we learned in a Braisa, Vahapta et Hashem Elokecha, you should love the Lord your God. You know what that means? Not that you have to love God, it means other people should love God because of you. Says, you know, you should have a person who learns and studies and he serves sages. And then that person deals with everybody in a nice way. So what do people say about him? Ashrei aviv shelimdo Torah. Wow. That guy's father is lucky as he taught him Torah. Ashrei rabo shelimdo Torah. How lucky is his Rebbe that he taught him Torah. Oy lehem libriot shelo limdu Torah. How sad is it for anybody who doesn't have the opportunity to sit in a room with us and learn Torah? Ploni shelimdo Torah ru'u kama na'im darcha. Wow, that guy learned Torah. How nice is he? What a great person. Kama mitukanim ma'asav. Look how everything he does is so good. But somebody who learns and studies and serves sages, but doesn't conduct business faithfully. And that person doesn't speak well with people. So what do people say about him? How sad is it that this person learned Torah? How sad for his father that he taught him Torah. What a waste. How pathetic for his teacher who taught him Torah. Ploni shelomad Torah, that guy who learned Torah. Ru kamaku kolim maasav kama muchlarin darchav. How broken are his things that he does. How ugly is the way that he leads his life. There's an unbelievable responsibility that we have as individuals. People who come into contact with Torah and people who say, we want to lead. We want more. We want more. And we do. We have this responsibility to go around and have people say about us, wow, what a good person. That person's good because they learned Torah. But you know what happened? I'll tell you a crazy thing. In the early 1900s, Japan started to wonder, why aren't we successful? The British are so rich, and they have a ginormous empire, and they're powerful armies. Why aren't we successful? You know what they decided to do? Don't take any chances. We'll copy everything. They got rid of their old social orders. They changed the way they dressed and began to dress like the finest English people. Okay? And they made sure to get an empire. Because you never know what makes them successful, right? Let's just copy everything. What I mean to show you by talking about Japan, and by the way, this worked for them. Their economy grew and they became incredibly powerful up until they challenged America in 1944. But it worked because they decided to copy the British, and the British had something that was working for them. And what I mean to say is that that's how people should feel about us. And it's not pie in the sky. It's not abnormal. It's not something that never happens. The truth is, when you see a successful person, so you say, what can I do? I want to be like that. I want to be like that. That's our job. Our job. So again, we really see three things from Hanukkah. You know, the first is that we have to seize the initiative because there's always going to be challenges, and God tells you, Mechuyav, you're obligated to take the baton of history, in Rav Lichtenstein's words. And the second thing is that we have to appreciate the good that we have, even though we know it is not perfect. We have to say, this is what it is. You can't just bury your head in the sand, and we shouldn't feel defensive. We should say, we know what we have. We know what the good is, we know what the bad is, we celebrate the good. And the last thing, we have to build on it. We have to take the banner of Yerushalayim, the Degel Yerushalayim that Rav Kook put out for us. You raise the banner and say, okay, we have what we have. We don't pretend that it's perfect. How do we get to the next level? And the most basic way of getting to the next level, because again, everybody knows, you know, the best thing you could do if you want to contribute to the modern state of Israel is just go live there, right? Contribute to the economy, build it. But the simplest thing we could do is have little building blocks in our lives. We could become so good that people see us and think, I want to be like that. And that's not just a general idea. That's how we change the world. That is how we make the modern state of Israel into what we want it to be. That's how we make our lives into what we want it to be. And the Torah tells us that not only is it so that if we act the way we should, other Jews will start acting the way they should, but in fact this will affect the entire rest of humanity because everybody wants to learn from what works. And we have to believe that the Torah does that if we simply allow ourselves to look in the mirror and say we have things to do. We have things to do as individuals, as a collective. If we do that, God willing, we'll really, really see all of that Rishit Tzimichah Gula Latinu become a final Gula. Everyone.